Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Michelle Valorci, and I'm an Outreach and Recruitment Specialist at the Institute of International Education here in Washington, D.C. Today, this webinar focuses on the Distinguished Chair Awards. These are specifically geared towards senior scholars who are experts in their field with a distinguished record in teaching and research. And I'm happy to have three of those scholars join me today. Dr. James Farquhar, Professor of Geology. He's currently on a grant in France. Dr. Karen Kaiser, Professor of Social Work, and Dr. Angus Rupert, Senior Aeromedical Research Scientist. And so they will be joining as a panel of a current grantee and alumni and sharing their insights about how they selected the award and what their experience was like on the grant. So without further ado, I'd like to begin the webinar. Okay, so a little bit of background on the Fulbright program. It was established in 1946 by Senator J. William Fulbright, and his goal was really to strengthen relationships between people of the United States and people around the world through education and research and creating mutual understanding. He himself had been a Rhodes Scholar to Oxford and really wanted to create a program for Americans to be able to go around the world and bring international scholars to the United States. The program is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, ECA, and IIE has been administering it since its inception, and we're happy to be celebrating our 72nd year, going on 73 years of this program, and it's really evolved through the decades from traditional kind of teaching and research grants to addressing issues like Arctic issues you see in the picture here through collaborative research. In terms of the baseline eligibility for the U.S. Scholar Program, it is a U.S. government program, so we do require U.S. citizenship. And then after that, it really depends on the award. So specifically, the awards that we're speaking about today will require a PhD or a terminal degree and significant teaching and research experience. But in general, we do have several awards that are open to early career professionals and postdocs, mid-career professionals, etc. So it's important to take a look at the award description. And if you're recently graduated from a master's or a bachelor's program, I encourage you to go on the U.S. student program website for more information about those opportunities. We do have new policies, relatively new policies, on previous Fulbright grant holders. If you're interested in reapplying to the program, we ask that you wait 2 years from the time that you completed the grant to the time that you apply. Now, in terms of the Distinguished Chair Awards, we have over 40 awards that offer multiple grants. So in total, there are about 100 Distinguished Chair grants available. So that's about 20% of the catalog of awards. So the catalog of awards features about 460 award offerings, and so it's a good percentage of what's available. Now, in terms of the requirement, as I mentioned, the Distinguished Chair Awards do require full professorship, and then they might list other kind of requirements such as language or things like that. So it's important to take a look at what those requirements are. I will be covering some of the regional highlights. It's by no means inclusive of everything, but certainly I tried to pull as many awards from the catalog as possible. And then we will just dive right into our discussion with our alumni and grantee. So this is really exciting. So the first region that I'd like to share with you are the awards to Northern Europe. You'll see that we've got the Distinguished Chair in American Studies in Denmark, so this is a wonderful opportunity for those in that field, American History, American Literature, American Studies. And then we have five Distinguished Chair awards to Finland. Finland is a, all of these countries, in fact, are what we call commission countries. So they have a binational Fulbright Commission located in that country. So they administer the grant, And they host several different events, including orientations and whatnot. And so Finland is a big contributor to the program, and they've got a lot of these partner awards. And so partner awards, you might hear me refer to, are opportunities that are particularly tied to a university that might be funding some of the position, or, you know, looking for a particular expert to join a particular department. So, for example, the Fulbright-Aalto University Distinguished Chair, that scholar will be placed at Aalto University. Now, the Bicentennial Chair, just to highlight, is one of the oldest chair award in the catalog. It was created in 1976, so there's a long history there with that award in Finland. And then moving on from Finland, we have the Arctic Chair in Norway. And this is a unique opportunity for a scholar from any appropriate field, really, to teach and research in the northern part of Norway on Arctic-related issues. So that's an exciting opportunity. And then we have the three chair awards to Sweden in a variety of fields. So one in energy technology, international law, public international law, and then also in American studies. And so if you think about the chair awards, a lot of times they're going to be very specific. They're looking for a specific discipline or research focus. And so oftentimes it might read like a job description, which can be a little overwhelming sometimes, but in a way it makes it easier to find a match based on your specialty. So that's something that's nice about the Distinguished Chair Awards, is there are a few that are open to all disciplines, but for the most part, they're really looking to place you in a particular department within a particular university. So that would be the case for the Lund University Chair in Public International Law. Moving on to the United Kingdom, they offer a bunch of awards. There's six chair opportunities available, and you'll see here all of these are actually partner awards. And so the one at Aberdeen is open to all disciplines, but again, it is partnered with the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. And then there's the one at Edinburgh in Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences. There's the All Disciplines opportunity at Birmingham University, as well as the one at Leeds. The one at the University of Manchester specifically focuses on humanities, so they're looking to attract scholars in any field of humanities for their department there. And then the university, Queen's University in Belfast, another partner award opportunity in Northern Ireland. So lots of great opportunities in the United Kingdom. So just be sure to take a look at the full description. And the other thing that I wanted to point out, when you click on these award details, these award descriptions, the partner award, since they do have a contact at the university that is in charge of, the Fulbright awards there, they will list the person's name and email address that you can contact to seek out a letter of invitation. I believe all of the chair awards do require a letter of invitation from the host. And so the useful thing about having a partner award is that you have a dedicated contact listed there in the award description to kind of provide the letter of invitation, or, you know, work with the department to see if you would be a good fit. They might ask for your resume. They might ask for, a brief abstract of, a brief summary of what you'd like to do on the grant. And then depending on, if they're interested in that, they will offer you the letter of invitation. Now, keep in mind, the letter of invitation is non-binding, so they might offer it to all of the eligible people that reach out and ask for a letter of invitation. But certainly it's a good sign if the partner university listed in the award offers you the letter of invitation. That's a good way to gauge interest in the beginning as you make the search through the catalog. Okay, moving on to Europe and Eurasia. We have, and I believe this is a new award this year to Austria, the Fulbright Catherine and Craig Hall Distinguished Chair for Entrepreneurship in Central Europe at Vienna University, and it's specifically economics and business. So that's kind of a mouthful, but certainly they're looking for someone who's an expert in entrepreneurship. This is a distinguished chair at Vienna University, and so it's an exciting opportunity to have impact as one of the first chairs in that department. And entrepreneurship in general, you'll notice that there are several awards in the Fulbright catalog that are focusing in on entrepreneurship or cybersecurity. So some of these are the new awards that we're featuring this year, starting with last year, getting more entrepreneurship and innovation experts to make an impact in Fulbright. We have the Schumann Chair at the European University Institute in Florence. Now, it's listed under EU because this award changes every year, so it switches every year from the European University Institute in Florence to the College of Europe in Brussels. So Brussels and Italy rotate this position. So the commission, the Fulbright Commission in Belgium, takes care of this award, and so you'll see it cross-listed as Italy as well as EU. So depending on the year that you're interested in going, it might not be in Italy. And there's usually a postdoc award that's affiliated as well. So they're looking for a junior scholar and a senior scholar to go to Italy as well. And then we've got the four awards to the Czech Republic. You can see here that they are partner awards as well. So again, you will find the contact person listed that would be able to issue the letter of invitation. We have the one award to France, the Fulbright Tocqueville Distinguished Chair, and our one of our grantees joining on the call is currently there in France, and so he'll be speaking more about that shortly. And then you'll see Hungary, Italy, Poland, and Russia have different awards as well, either partner awards or also very particularly looking for agriculture or sustainable development. Okay, and then moving along to the Western Hemisphere, we have three chair awards to Brazil, and Brazil again is another large commission country. They have several awards in general, but three in for distinguished chairs, and they also contribute to the funding of the program, which is wonderful, and they're very actively engaged with Fulbrighters on the ground once they start their grant. So we have the Distinguished Chair in American Studies at the Federal University of Minas Gerais, the International Relations Chair at the University of Sao Paulo, and the Distinguished Chair in Public Policy at the School of Innovation and Public Policy at Joaquim Nabuco Foundation. So those are the three highlights of Brazil. Now, for the sake of space, we have several chairs. We actually have a total of 10 chair awards to Canada, and they are in a range of fields and disciplines. So we've just kept two of them here to kind of keep it on your radar, but Canada offers several chair opportunities, so I would encourage you to view those in the catalog. Some of them are open to any discipline, but they do list a partner university, and depending on, for example, if you click on Field Open, the research chairs with Open Field, they'll list three partner universities that you can be placed at. And then depending on your discipline, that will dictate where you'll be placed. So take a look at the wonderful opportunities in Canada. There's lots going on there, and they're really excited to host experts from the United States at their universities. We have the award to Colombia. This is in biodiversity and sustainable development. We're really happy to have this award. It's relatively new. The only thing I wanted to point out with Colombia is they may have and this also goes, the same is true for Brazil and France, there might be a language proficiency requirement if your research requires knowledge of the local language. If not, if you can justify or rationalize or explain how the research can be carried out without knowledge of that particular language, please do so in the project statement, and then you would not be required to complete the language proficiency report. And we'll hear more from James about how that worked out for him in France. Okay, and then the last set of awards in East Asia and the Pacific, and the one award we have in South Asia. So Australia is another big powerhouse of distinguished chair opportunities. So alongside Canada, we've got lots of opportunities in Australia, and we do have an alum who's with us on the call today who will be speaking about the one that's the first award featured, the Fulbright Distinguished Chair in Advanced Science, Defense and Technology at the DST Group. Angus will be telling us about that, and then we've got one in public policy, one in arts and humanities and social sciences at Australia National University in Canberra, and then again another one, we talked about entrepreneurship being something big, so this one's in entrepreneurship and innovation, and then the chair at Newcastle, and that's open to multiple disciplines, mostly in the sciences STEM fields. And then the last one, the Distinguished Chair in Science, Technology, and Innovation in Australia at the CSIRO, it's also kind of working alongside the DST group that we mentioned in the first award. So lots of great things happening in Australia. And again, this is a commission country, so they do hold the orientations for grantees when they arrive in the country. There's a gala, a dinner, and all of that, so it's wonderful. If you're looking for opportunities in Australia. We do have a distinguished chair to China in the social sciences. So in general, a lot of the awards in East Asia and the Pacific are very, very interested in bringing Americans from the arts, the sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities, teaching, creative writing or American studies and things like that. And so China does have several of those opportunities in addition to the Distinguished Chair in Social Sciences. The Distinguished Lectureship at Yonsei University is another exciting opportunity, and it is open to all disciplines, and the chair will be placed at Yonsei, so you can reach out to the contact listed there. And then last but not least, we have the Fulbright Nehru Distinguished Chair, and this is open to all disciplines. It's the only chair award in the South and Central Asia region, and we're lucky to have Dr. Karen Kaiser on the call, and she was a distinguished chair to South India, to Chennai, and she'll be sharing more about that. So moving along, I wanted to first introduce Dr. Angus Rupert. He is a senior research scientist at the Aircrew Health and Performance Division at the U.S. Army Aeromedical Research Laboratory. His award was the chair to Australia, the distinguished chair in advanced defense science and technology. And the project he did was tactile cueing to improve situational awareness and reduce workload. So Angus, can you maybe start off and share a little bit about what led you to this award and what your experience was like?
Okay, I'm back on speaker. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, coming in clear. Great.
So my background was I originally started out on the other side. I grew up as a Canadian, and while in graduate school in Canada, I was quite familiar with the Fulbright, as were all my graduate student compadres at the time. And my supervisor said, hey, I'm going to the United States. I'd like you to come and help me start a new medical school at the University of Illinois. And I agreed to do that and went down to Illinois, but I'd also been accepted into medical school in Toronto. So I had to do a degree on each side of the border, and the only way I could do that was to start a skydiving school, to buy an airplane, which allowed me to commute back and forth between the two countries. With that interest, I ended up joining with NASA and spending several years with NASA, the U.S. Navy, and the U.S. Army, developing a particular technology that I knew would be of interest to military in any country. And since things move very slowly in the United States, I thought, Australia, here's a smaller country with less bureaucracy, and perhaps I could make things move more quickly there. So I saw the Fulbright chair, and I immediately started calling the folks at the Defense Science and Technology group now. It's listed as DSTO here on the slide, but it's DSTG now. And I applied with them. And the first and maybe the most difficult part, I would think, of applying for a scholar grant is getting that letter of recommendation. You want a very strong letter from your host country. And it was quite a bit of legwork to find the right person, but after having done that, everything went very smoothly. And if I could emphasize any one thing that I really appreciated about the Fulbright program, it was that it opened doors. Just the word Fulbright in Australia, that's about all that it takes. Knowing that most people there know it's part of the U.S. State Department, and I was able to make advances that could not have been made by certainly people within their own science and technology group. I was the expert from out of town, you might say. And I was able to actually organize and carry out a flight test, which in the military normally takes a couple of years to accomplish, and we did it in 5 to 6 months. I extended for an extra month to do that. But I would say that one of my most pleasurable experiences was that I would go around and provide lectures, University of Melbourne, elsewhere around the country, various groups in the aeromedical world, and it was everyone was quite familiar with what the Fulbright organization was. I would always give them the full background and the Senator Fulbright himself, but the doors that would open and the prestige associated with the Fulbright program is quite impressive. So I had a thoroughly enjoyable experience, and I would say that it's certainly worth the effort to chase down one of these scholarships. Are there any questions?
All right, Dr. Ubert, thank you for sharing that. We will take a look at the question box. We see that some are coming in.
Okay.
But I just wanted to follow up with a question about the letter of invitation. So you mentioned
right.
how important that was. So currently in our catalog, we do have the contact person listed with his email and name. Was there somebody that was listed in the award that you were able to contact, or was it difficult for you at that point?
Well, what I did is I had supported a graduate student for his PhD at the University of Sydney once, and prior to that for his master's at MIT. And I started with him to find out who would be the key people within this DSTG organization. And then I slowly worked through, and after about 15 phone calls, I had set the lay of the land, so to speak, and so that when I called the contact person, I already had a great deal of familiarity with what their lab was and what they were trying to accomplish, and could then frame what I had to offer with respect to what they needed. And so it worked quite smoothly once I got to that point. But there was probably, I'd say, 10 to 15 different people I talked to before I made that initial call to be sure I had the right background for it.
Excellent. Actually, that's wonderful advice. So doing a little bit of research before contacting the host institution, and then that way you also appear better informed and you have a set of questions that you have maybe in mind that you'd like to answer before kind of proceeding further with that. Great, thank you. Let's move on and introduce our other guest, Dr. Karen Kaiser, Professor Dr. Renato La Rocca, Endowed Chair in Oncology Social Work at the School of Social Work at the University of Louisville, and she was the grantee, the Fulbright Nehru Distinguished Chair grantee to India, based at the Cancer Institute in Chennai, and her project title was Integrating Psycho-Oncology Research into Cancer Care. So Karen, would you like to share a little bit about your approach to the Fulbright program and how you landed up in Chennai?
Hello, Karen.
Are you well? Yeah. And thank you for this opportunity to speak with potential Fulbrighters. So how I ended up in India, first I might mention that I had a Fulbright to Milan, Italy about 10 years earlier. So I was familiar already with the Fulbright program, and that particular Fulbright award was for research. So when I had a sabbatical come up, I thought, well, let's do something maybe a little more challenging and do something in research and teaching. And I had taken several trips to India, in this particular area, South India, leading student groups there to study human services and social problems in South India. And decided that, you know, since I was familiar with India, I had contacts there, that perhaps I would pursue my distinguished chair there. And so my area of expertise is in psychosocial oncology, which is basically research and practice with cancer patients and their families. You know, our research focuses on, you know, how best to adjust to cancer, what are ways to help cancer patients deal with any type of psychosocial issue. It could be emotional distress, depression, anxiety. It could be practical things around, you know, the financial aspects of cancer treatment. So it covers a broad area. And as I was establishing my own psychosocial oncology program here at the University of Louisville, I happened to come across that there were actually two similar educational programs that in India. So I thought, well, it'd be interesting to go and find out what they're doing there and to kind of exchange ideas. The year before I was going to take my sabbatical, I actually went to India and met with these two cancer centers, one in Chennai, one in Bangalore. And I did some lecturing there just to see if those were potential places I'd want to spend my Fulbright. And I actually chose Bangalore as my first choice, primarily just because I hadn't spent much time in Bangalore. I've been to Chennai a number of times, and their program seemed to be very well established and resources and so on. But it turned out that they were concerned about their bandwidth and, you know, some of the things that I would need to do my work, and also they were concerned about the amount of time it would take to get my proposal approved. They were a private cancer center. So I then changed it to the Cancer Institute in Chennai, and they quickly responded and wrote me a very strong recommendation letter. And I do want to just reemphasize what Dr. Rupert had said about you really need to be sure that the hosts want you, and to state that in the letter. I found that true also when I went to Milan, Italy. A lot of people would like to go to Italy, and I had to make sure that I had really good connections with the people there before, you know, I even submitted my proposal. So in terms of what I did there then, I at the Cancer Institute, my goal was to help build their research capacity. Cancer is going, I mean, cancer is increasing there as an increasing rate, and you know, they have certain practices, interventions that they will do with the cancer patients, but a lot of their interventions are borrowed from the Western world, and they haven't really done research to support what they're doing in India. So in other words, what they apply to their population may not be culturally appropriate. So my goal was to help them build their research capacity, and so I did a lot of mentoring, workshops, lectures, and then the other thing that I did was I taught a course at a women's college on health disparities. So that was kind of another teaching part. Basically, my research was kind of integrated with the teaching so that, you know, when I was at the Cancer Institute, I was teaching them research, but we were also doing research together. The other thing that I'd like to add that's a little makes the distinguished chair a little different from, I think, the other awards is that you are expected to travel around the country and give lectures. And the lectures could be to an audience of researchers, scientists, practitioners, or the general public. So you, I would just say you have to feel comfortable doing, you know, a lot of lecturing and speaking engagements to across a people. And of course, in my field, that included, you know, being able to, you know, present to cancer patients and their families and caregivers, and along with, you know, the scientists and the practitioners. So I just wanted to talk a little about your project statement. And again, you know, as you're applying, things to think about. When I came back from India, I actually volunteered to review Fulbright applications to India, and these were of all different disciplines. So I have, you know, basically about three suggestions here, or four suggestions, on your project statement. And the first one is to be really clear about your objectives, how you plan to achieve them, and the outcomes you're expecting. And try to put this in really plain English, because I was reviewing all sorts of you know, disciplines, and although there were other discipline reviewers, if I couldn't understand what, you know, the applicant was planning to do, it was hard to really grade them and review them. So you just try to be really clear about your objectives, how you're going to achieve them, and the outcomes. Make a case for why your project is important, meets a need in your host country. Again, you know, what I looked for in the applications were, what difference is it going to make to India that you're doing this project? And then why you have experience to complete the project. Again, we're looking for, you know, what your expertise is, what your experience has been, and why you are maybe the best person to do this project. And then finally, a plan for cultural exchange. How is this proposal going to be translated back to translated back to the U.S. and you know, maybe where you teach or you do your research. I mean, so you want to make sure that there's this exchange, not only that you're giving to them, but they're also giving to you. So I don't know if you want me to go on more, Michelle, or just at this point ask questions.
So, Dr. Kaiser, you did an excellent job. I think you should join our outreach team. These are the things that we highlight all the time on our webinars and on phone calls when people are curious, you know, what makes a competitive application. It's really, I mean, the project statement certainly is at the core of it, and I think all of the points that you outlined are 100% on, you know, exactly what applicants should be thinking about, being as clear as possible and outlining potential outcomes, et cetera. So let's move on to our third panelist, and then we'll take questions to the panel. We've got several that have come in, and then we can kind of explore a little more about each of your experiences. So thank you so much for that. Moving on, we have Dr. James Farquhar on the call, calling in from Paris, and he is a professor in the Department of Geology, specifically the Earth System Science Interdisciplinary Center at University of Maryland College Park. He is on the Fulbright-Tocqueville Distinguished Chair in to France, hosted at the Institut de Physique du Globe de Paris, Université de Paris, the project titled Teaching and Research in Isotopic Geochemistry and Cosmochemistry. So James, welcome to the call.
Thank you. I guess for everyone who's there, I'm in the middle of the fellowship at the moment, living in Paris, where I'm calling you from. I started in southern France, actually, before the fellowship began, and also count that because it has been sort of part of a continuous experience. What I found is that my job here involves giving lectures, various institutions, and then teaching and working with students in addition to research. And this is different than the pure research-focused experiences that I had on my first sabbatical. It's also very rewarding, but it takes a lot of effort. What I'm finding is I end up making connections with people from here and from various places in France. In fact, I have someone who will join me next fall for a year Fulbright to do work. And the, let's see, and I can still get away somewhat to do some research, but a lot of my focus does end up being on teaching, which is, as it turns out, making it into a much richer experience. Why did I choose France? I chose it for research capabilities that the institution that I was visiting had, and instrumentation that they had that really did not exist in the U.S. So it gave me an opportunity that was distinct from what I would have had pretty much anywhere else that I had chosen. It also was ideally suited to the work that I was doing. I also chose it for personal reasons, because I can speak French, and I thought that it would work well with my family. So we have ended up being very, very comfortable living here and working with students here. Although most of the people in the laboratory that I work do end up speaking English instead of French. And then sort of the final reason had to do with the people who I knew somewhat, and I had seen their students come by and met them in a variety of different situations, and found them to be very sort of forthright and logical. And that was something that I thought was interesting from the standpoint of teaching. Now, there are various benefits that I would say, and they are, in this case, country-specific, because I'm finding that the researchers and students and the style of doing research and describing what one is doing is different than what I'm accustomed to in the U.S. And this was something that I learned a little bit about and was a little familiar with at the time of putting together the application, and was also something that I emphasized being interested in doing, and one of the reasons why I was interested in the teaching opportunity. And let's see, for the experience here upon arriving, I've had very good experiences with the Fulbright Commission here in terms of providing practical information. I also, and I didn't do this so much myself, but I've seen other people do this, is to reach out to the people at the commission and ask for information and assistance and guidance when there are questions that come up. There are one or two other things I was thinking about with respect to setting up the proposals, and I'd like to echo a lot of the points that Karen made. I think from my experience, it is very critical to have that connection where it has to be clear. I ended up sitting on a panel to review the proposals, and they all were excellent, but what struck me was many of them were outside my discipline, and I spent a lot of time looking up the words and trying to understand the content and understand why they were important. And this, I found, was something that required the reviewers to do work, because they're outside of the discipline in many cases. The other thing that I think was critical was showing that there were benefits both to the person who was proposing and then also to the institution. And they don't have to be things that are necessarily groundbreaking, but they do have to be really pretty clear. And I think I will stop there and just see, Michelle, if there are other things that you would like me to cover.
Great. Thank you, James. So we've actually received some specific questions for all three of you. So let's get to those, and then we can maybe have some other questions that typically come from applicants. So the first one we have for you, James, is the teaching load that you have currently, is it the same that you would have normally at College Park, or is it more, or how would you describe it?
It's different because the institution where I am gives these very, very long classes, so they can be 4-hour long classes. And so for the teaching, it's much more focused, focused with a relatively small group of 12 students. And also what I'm doing is I'm working mostly with doctoral students. So we're working on specific problems that are related to what I'm doing. I am teaching two courses, and the hours are dictated, but they end up being 6 or so 4-hour meetings, which require a fair amount of preparation and work, but also are very rewarding.
Okay, great. So if we were to ask you for a ratio, kind of a breakdown, is it a 50-50 teaching research breakdown, or is it a little bit more towards the teaching?
You know, it depends a lot on how focused the lecturing is. So I get the feeling that this depends also on what institution and what discipline one is teaching in, specifically in France. The way that my fellowship has worked out was I've had a block where I wasn't teaching, and then I have had a block where there's fairly intense teaching, and then I'll have another block where I will not be teaching. Now, scattered throughout that are various lectures, and they have filled in, and what is surprising is that they end up being on every single possible topic. I don't give the same lecture because the audience is very different. So it's a different experience than a pure research experience.
Got it. Thank you so much. We have a question for Dr. Rupert, and it says, how did you decide on your project? Was that done in consultation with the host institution so that it would be mutually beneficial? And how much time did you finally get to spend on your research project?
Well, the reason for my topic, it was a technology that I had started to develop here in the United States. So I had the technology already, and there was an interest in the government, on behalf of the government of Australia, to transition that technology. So I already had the topic in place, shall we say. And in terms of how much time, that is another one of the wonderful things about the Senior Scholars Program, in that I was entirely on my own with 100% freedom to do whatever I want at any time, so that I was able to travel from the north, Townsville in Australia, to the south of Melbourne where I was, and every point in between, providing briefs to all of the people that I needed to gain permission from, so that I was entirely on my own with complete and total freedom over time, including when I would choose to give lectures. I was able to also, for example, run off to New Zealand and spend a week there and provide some lectures to people in their Department of Defense. So I would say that the DSTO gave me complete freedom to do whatever I wanted according to the schedule I chose, as long as I was driving it towards this ultimate flight test, which, as I said, I had to spend an extra month in country to pull it off. But it all worked out very well.
Okay, great. And I'd like to just jump in and clarify that the award that Dr. Rupert was on was 100% research. So the award description was looking for a research chair. The awards that Dr. Kaiser and Dr. Farquhar are on are teaching or teaching and research. So in the case of India, the option is teaching or teaching and research. And then for the Tocqueville Award to France, it's teaching combined with research. So it's important to check what grant activity is sought. There's a good number that are just focused on research, and then others really want you to weigh in on teaching in terms of the curriculum or advising doctoral students, et cetera, maybe teaching a higher level course as Dr. Farquhar is with the PhD students. So it's important to take a look at what the grant activity is. All right, moving on to the next question we have for, I think it's Dr. Kaiser, we have a question. Let's go back to, oh, we've got a question for Dr. Farquhar. Do the French students in your class have a good level of English proficiency for your teaching, or are you teaching in French?
I'm not teaching in French. Part of that, well, it would be difficult for me to teach in French. My language is not at that level. However, I can talk in the laboratory one-on-one with the students. The other thing is there are a lot of non-French speakers who are also in the school. So I teach in English. The level of proficiency of the French students in science is phenomenal. So they understand everything. They work on writing. Part of what I emphasized and part of what I thought in terms of developing something that I could offer them was to work with their writing in English. And what I find is that their scientific writing is very, very clear and avoids a lot of the problems that I see in the U.S. writing, probably because they're focused on the logic and the argument and making sure there's content there. So the students have been wonderful and wonderful to work with.
Excellent. Great. So we had a question, kind of a generic question, and I think I can take this one. Is Fulbright only for academics, as in professorship required? So this person is outside of academia. So the answer to that would be if you have a terminal degree that's required, you know, as required in the award description, and the host institution is interested in you, and if the award specifically states open to academics and those and professionals appropriately qualified outside of academia, then you would be welcome to. I know that there are several awards that are only open to academics, and the interest is really to not only have a professor come and serve as a chair in that department in that country, but also to continue the institutional collaborations between the two universities. And so do take a look at the specific award details for each award. All right, we have another question. Let's see, what's the next one? Dr. Kaiser, could you explain a little bit about, now did you do a teaching and research combination and how that ratio was determined?
Okay, yes, I did a teaching and research, and I would say that most of it was teaching, I was teaching research. For my research, I had planned to do a study that would use data that they already had, which would be abstracted from their medical records, from their clinical records. And so it was going to be a study that kind of illustrated to them how they could do research in a clinical setting, and that it didn't require recruiting participants, and because the data collection in my field can be very take a long time. So I thought I'd just go there and then propose this protocol, and we would just abstract the data. One thing about India is that you're never lacking for people. When I went there and I said, you know, I'd propose this protocol, and I said, how many, you know, they said, well, we're already collecting the data. We've already collected the data. We have the data set. And I said, well, how big is the sample? And they said, like 5,000 people, patients. I thought, okay, this is going to move along pretty quickly because we have our data. We had to clean it and so on. But, you know, we could start with analysis right away. So the nice thing about proposing this particular study was that it didn't take long to do because they had already had the data. So that's why I didn't really spend as much time actually doing research as I did in teaching it. So that, yeah, I don't know if that totally answers the question. Are there any other questions related to that? But I would say it was about like a 60% teaching and 40%, maybe not even 40%, actually doing research.
Okay, great. And I just wanted to highlight, we've gotten some questions as to how long Distinguished Chair grants tend to be, and I would say that for the most part, they're about a semester in length, so roughly. So you won't find a full year commitment required. A lot of them do allow you to be there for 4 to 5 months. But they do want you to be there and have impact in the department. So anything less than 3 months is usually not part of the Distinguished Chair offerings. We have a question about teaching and curriculum awards. Are they only ever made in the Distinguished Chair category? In this case, do you have to have a research proposal? And I think, you know, the answer to that is certainly, regardless of what you're proposing to do, there needs to be a research or a teaching proposal. And so if it is just a teaching-focused grant that you're looking at, and feel free to chime in, James and Karen, as to what that looks like when you're building a proposal for teaching.
I can say something. So from my standpoint, I basically divided up the proposal into parts. And for the, I had a research part where I described the project that we were going to do and why we were going to do it and what sort of exchange there was that was involved. Then I thought, tried to think about, okay, what is it that I can do with respect to teaching and what is it that I can offer and what is it that I can benefit from with respect to teaching. And I had worked with some students from France and was always impressed by how they approached problems. So I ended up actually focusing on something related to their ability to work on problems, but then thought about, okay, what could I do to help them, and focused on the idea of teaching and working with them on writing in our particular subject area. And so as far as setting up the proposal itself, it probably ended up being about sub-equal teaching and research with a small introduction and then a small personal part about my rationale and reasons for doing that. But a lot of that was dictated by the application process itself. So I read that and they said, we want about this, these things should be sub-equal, and we want these other things, and I just divided them up and then went through and tried to explain them. I did try to make the case that there would be long-term benefits both for myself and for the institution I was visiting. And I think those things also are valuable and get helped.
Great. And Karen, do you have anything to chime in?
Yeah, I mean, I approached it in a very similar way with different parts of the proposal focus on research and teaching. And I may just add, too, something that I thought might be somewhat innovative. And you saw in that picture, that photo of me with my class at the Women's College. Well, I was teaching health disparities as a course that I also teach at the University of Louisville, and it was being taught by one of my colleagues at the same time I was over in Chennai teaching it to the students in Chennai. So we actually arranged several video conferencing exchanges with the class in Chennai and the class back in the U.S. Now, timing can be a challenge because my students in the U.S. had to come in at 8 o'clock in the morning and the other students had to stay around 6 o'clock in the evening. But that was a way that I was trying to promote this cultural exchange between the students in both countries. So that was a regular course that I had a syllabus for, and then I had a section where I described workshops that I was going to do at the Cancer Institute, and then other public lectures. And so I just had it divided by, kind of like my research protocol and then these other teaching experiences.
Excellent. Great. Thank you. So we are down to the last 4 minutes. We'll take a few more questions And I think all three of you can chime in. So the question is, are you able to travel during the term of the award? And specifically for James, were you able to travel out of the Eurozone?
So absolutely able to travel. Part of the traveling out of the Eurozone, I guess, would depend in part on visas. So when we first arrived, it wasn't possible because of dealing with the visa situation. But once that was settled, I have been to, well, within the Eurozone, to Ireland and then to Scotland to give lectures. And the other Fulbright fellows here also have done a lot of traveling with respect to giving lectures and I think some touristing. But I think mine will follow after I'm done with this.
Great. Yeah, one advantage of the Distinguished Chair is that they do provide you with extra funds for, you know, for traveling and giving lectures in other cities. And yeah, so I did quite a bit of that too in India.
Excellent. And Angus, I mean, you mentioned you spent a week in New Zealand. Were there other travels within Australia or in the region?
Within 4 hours of my arrival, I had purchased a car and made my adventures on the wrong side of the road, but I put on more than 28,000 kilometers in just a few months, not to mention the rental of RV vehicles to travel from the bottom to the top of the East Coast. So lots of travel, and I always had presentations ready to go, so to speak, because there were many impromptu presentations that I gave while I was in Australia. And I would echo one other thing that had been mentioned by, I think, both of the other participants, and that was that in terms of making that application simple and easy to read, when I had finished my own application, I handed it to my IRB, that's Investigational Review Board, and they tried to have things written for subjects at a grade 5 level. I said, can you raise the level about 3 or 4 years? and had a review done so that people that are reviewing the application will find it quite readable and at a level that they'll be able to understand no matter what their level of background expertise is.
Excellent. Great. Well, we have 1 minute left. And if you're not in a rush, we can take a couple more questions. One of them is, for any of you, did your positions as chairs on your Fulbright grant, did it require you to interact with PhD students? Now, I know, James, you're teaching PhD students, but Karen and Angus, I think yours was just research. So, Karen, were you working with students? At what level were they?
They were at the level of what they call MPhil scholars, which are masters in philosophy with a specialization in psycho-oncology. So similar to kind of our PhD, because they were required to have a master's to get an MPhil. And those are most of the students I interacted with at the Cancer Institute. And there were also a couple PhD students there also that I was mentoring.
Okay, great. And so all of you have worked with doctoral students at your home campuses in the U.S., is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's correct.
Great. So
I think currently sponsor several PhDs, this is Angus speaking, and while in Australia I had a lot of docs and postdocs that I was providing equipment to, and I'm still providing them that equipment while I'm here in the U.S. as part of my my follow-on from the program.
Excellent, great. So thank you all for your presence today and participating in the webinar. We have reached a minute after the hour, so I don't want to impose any more on your time. I want to thank all the audience members who joined in and for your wonderful questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them, but we will try and follow up with you individually. This webinar has been recorded, and so it will be archived on our website next week. So stay tuned for that. And again, thank you so much, Dr. Rupert, Dr. Kaiser, and Dr. Farquhar, calling in from Paris today. I really appreciate your insights and your valuable advice that you've given to our applicants, and yes, keep spreading the Fulbright mission around the world, and thank you once again. And this concludes the webinar. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.